Never an easy thing to do, but we managed to capture the golden tiger for a chat today. It was awesome and really appreciate Joel giving his time. He's been in fantastic recent form, as any squash fans will know, in Egypt and last week making the final at Canary Wharf. I thought it was really interesting to hear from Joel and to hear, you know, his lessons learned over the duration of his career, last 7 or 8 years. And just to, you know, get a little bit off topic and to talk things that are not related to squash necessarily. He's a top guy and a great personality for the game. Please enjoy and pass it on to someone else you think will enjoy it too. Cheers. Here we go, boys. Welcome to the studio. We got the golden tiger in today.
Cheers, mate.
Welcome, great to John. Get on.
Roaring into the studio.
Yeah, exactly. A couple of tough points. Although I thought, just listening back to Phil's a couple of weeks ago, and I thought that was a level up for sure.
Special guest, Phil, really, in several senses of the word.
I hope you're listening to that in the right circumstances, you know, on the way back from the league matches.
Well, yeah, I mean, I saw you post it, and I was just finished Northwest Counties, actually, so just in time for me to take a diversion off the motorway halfway back to Birmingham.
Probably the perfect length for a drive back from a Northwest league, that, especially considering like an M6 night closure.
Yeah, it was spot on at just about 2 hours 25 in the end instead of an hour. Isn't it a well travelled path, as we all know?
How's the? I hear the voice is still a little bit croaky, which it's been an issue for the last couple of days.
Yeah, it's not. We tried to do it yesterday, but it wasn't coming through very clearly. It's just about doing okay today. Trying to be able to talk over the weekend. Me, Mars and Jack went across to try and get the UFC on. We went to see Jack's new place in Clapham. He's just moved across there over the last couple of weeks. So tried a quiet bar to watch the UFC and analyze and listen to some commentary, but there was a pretty, there's a DJ and some interesting music drops going on at the same time. So didn't manage to really see much because people were in front of the TV for 90% of it.
You weren't in infernos, were you?
No.
We were. That's where we ended up, though.
Yeah, we progressed onto there afterwards. But
we should say this is after Canary Wharf, so this is at the end of a pretty brutal 2-week stint for all those squash fans. I'm sure they watched most of your matches, but I can appreciate you. You're probably a bit run down after that.
Right, yeah, it's straight from Calgary into Blackball and then into Canary Wharf, so haven't really had much time off, so probably a little bit run down, and as well as a lot of shouting trying to hear each other on Saturday didn't help. And then ready to go.
After crisscrossing across the globe and playing a lot of matches, winning a lot of matches, but a lot of travel, you know, the thing you want to recover the most is a few beers in Clapham, isn't it, watching the UFC on a Saturday.
Well, a perfect way to get the recovery right going into another week. So it's just kind of what it takes.
That's what you don't get that in Cairo, can you? After your matches.
No, I don't think it was showing much there. But yeah, it was a...
How's the body feeling? Never mind the voice. How's the body feeling after some of these battles? Yeah,
a few bruises and a few cuts to carry into next week. But I never had so many messages about a blister across the bottom of my foot that are just bleeding everywhere. Posted a picture of that last week, and unfortunately that's pretty normal. But most weeks, if I'm in a tournament, it looks a bit like that. So yeah, just healing up nicely at the minute. Eyes sorted, and the knuckles are healing up, and ready to pull up again this week.
Sounds like you've been in the cage, not squash court.
Yeah, that's the dream, mate. That's the dream.
You've had a fairly good run of form last sort of 6 weeks or so.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I've sort of felt good again. Body's come back. I had a bit of a patch where I couldn't get my body right after Commonwealth. Yeah, a few issues, and then I felt strong again. So, felt my squash was in a decent place, but my body wasn't right. And then had a couple of weeks where it came together quite nicely, and I feel strong. And you need, once I'd done that, I felt like I could have done that a little bit earlier, but I didn't have those, that match practice. You still need that sharpness of ESA matches, and that, you know, just need to be a bit more astute. You can train well and hit well, as we all know, in practice, and it starts to feel like it's coming together, but you need, you know, 3-4 good matches at a top level, and then you feel, you know, sharp again.
I guess mentally as well, it's good, like, for confidence and stuff, isn't it? Once you've got, especially, I suppose, after winning a title as well in Canada, that must have been a pretty nice, pretty good feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I think it actually helped going down a level slightly to like a 50K, because you can sometimes be playing the World Series and you can be playing anyone from the first day. And sometimes if you could lose, you know, playing a good match to one of the top guys tight, and it's sort of hard to know where you are at that point. Whereas Calgary, I played like a few guys, still quality players, but like 40 in the world, 30 in the world, 20, and then 10. And I felt like I got 4 matches in 4 days. And it was like as good a training as you're going to get, really. So that made me feel like I knew body wise, I felt fit, I felt strong, and gave me a few things to work on squash wise before black ball. So just it accumulates, doesn't it? If you get the right balance of matches and a bit of physical background before going into it, you can feel fit, can't you?
I'd assume so.
I was going to say,
winning's a habit, but that's so I've heard.
One thing we've never said to others is dropping down to a 50K. we'd be absolutely, that'd be a highlight of our career, mate, if we qualified for one of those. But
dropping down to county closed, I know how that feels. Yeah.
to be fair, mate, we qualified for a few 50s in India, I seem to remember.
that was a 30 actually, but I got ill, so never mind.
I know that. Remember the one you were talking about actually there, Joel. It's the most outwardly confident I think I've ever been. I don't know if I was, but I think I was just hanging around with you. It just rubbed off on me. But I remember us, we were there in the hotel for the qualifying, and there's obviously in the main draw they usually leave the spots open. So they said to us that they were like, you guys are going to check out today because then you check back in if you're qualifying. And we pretty much just said to the guy at the desk, we're like, no, those two qualifying spots, that's us, mate. you're looking at them. Don't worry about it.
Oh, one and two together, mate. We're in that one. Yeah. We'll see.
We're not taking our bags out. Yeah. And it actually worked for once. So that was quite nice.
That was up there with one of your most, well, there's been a few I can think of, but aggressive and intense approaches to a match. And you were sharp on and off against an informed Chris Binney, I seem to remember.
Exactly.
Was there a plan B there in case the matches didn't go your way? No.
For once, no.
Onto the streets of Mumbai, was it? Or
for once there wasn't. Yeah, I think it was just single-minded approach. Worked. Didn't happen very often, but yeah. So obviously you're in between events here, Joel, but it's what we want to see back in the hotel. But how do you get over these matches then? So when you know a match like a cell, how are you recovering from that? Because you haven't got long before that in the next round, next day.
In that case, it was probably a 100-minute match, but about 50 minutes of squash. So it wasn't a particularly like hard one physically. It's more just what a bizarre matching situation to be in. So my body actually felt okay going into that, maybe just a fraction heavy because of the last couple of weeks. You just haven't had much time to, you know, really actually rest and go again. It just sort of felt one match into the next. So it's boring stuff, isn't it? It's getting in bed at a decent time and getting 10 hours sleep, which is hard. You're wired after a match. That's the biggest thing in those tournament matches. If you can switch off and get some good sleep, the training's in your legs, so you don't need, I tend to think you don't need to force out like a practice hit and get in the gym massively on a match day. Just if you've had a match like that the night before, just get the physio right, get a load of sleep and actually come out at a decent pace again in the night, rather than trying to go down to the club at 10 a.m, hit a few balls, come back and then have the day all broken. But I always try to just recover as much as I can and then go like flat out again in the night if I can.
Good advice there.
That's what I do. I don't know. I'm sure other people have different approaches, but I tend to struggle to switch off after playing, especially if you play that kind of match. You get off court at 1 p.m. or something like that. I'm not going to sleep before 3 a.m. at that point. So if other people sleep by 12, that's a big advantage, I think, in a tournament, because you just, a lot of adrenaline and you end up eating late and it's hard to switch off.
Yeah. And it's got to help having like an actual physio, like going back to the mum by 50k or 5k. So that, you know, there's no physio, there's not even a physio on site there that you can pay for, never mind like having someone dedicated to you for the week or whatever, but it's got to help out in that.
Yeah, I mean, people tend to think these matches are hard, but I mean, you just, if you're on a glass court with nice nice sprung floors and you've got a physio before and after your matches and back to a nice hotel, it's a luxury, mate, I would say, compared to some of the situations we've all been in over the years. So, yeah, you compare that to a backcourt match somewhere in India playing for 100 minutes with no physio and humidity and, yeah, preparation's probably not been quite as good as it is these days. It feels easy in comparison, I'd say. Bit of guaranteed money in a hotel, guaranteed for the night. Night after. You're
sleep,
laughing, really.
Sleep a bit better.
You'd hope that unsprung floors are behind you now. If you end up on an unsprung floor, something's probably gone wrong.
You're never too far away from high tin.
High tin, sealed, a nice sealed floor.
Always around the corner.
Trip to Australia, and sealed floor.
Well, that nicely brings us on to the early days, yeah. I think that the first time I ever heard about you, Joel, was it may have been Creedy actually. He was like, oh yeah, there's this kid in back in Wales, he can do 88 court sprints in 4 minutes. And I was like, yeah, I mean, his squash isn't there yet, but yeah, he's a bloody good athlete. But I think that was the first I ever heard of you. But then obviously then you came to Birmingham, so that was where we probably first all met in Birmingham when you moved to the university there.
Yeah, I mean, up until about 18, 19, I hadn't been around any pros of like any kind of level, really. So going to Birmingham Uni and seeing, you know, all you boys were there training. There was a good group at that point, and similar level to myself. George was just coming in at he was probably a year younger than me. But yeah, a better level than me at the time. Nathan Lake was there, wasn't he? Chris Ryder, you were there. It was just such a good, it was the perfect level for me at that point where I could come in any morning of the week and get battered 3-love, occasionally 3-1, and yeah, for sleep and do it again. And that was really helpful for me because I'd never had matches like that where I could just learn from playing matches. I'd done a lot of the work, done a lot of solo, a lot of ghosting, because there just wasn't that many people around at that point. I benefited from that a lot.
You started quite late, didn't you, as well? You didn't start playing till you were, was it 14th? Or was that, it's been exaggerated?
I played squash from 10, 11 probably, but it was like once a week at a local leisure centre. It was just a, it'd be 10 of us playing 3 quarters. It's not like the academy setups you see in Cairo. It's on court. It was 10 of us playing 3 quarters. And yeah, there was always court sprints to finish. It was actually a great local club. It wasn't a high level, but there's probably 30, 40 kids playing every week. There was like a big group of us all playing. It was a great, great group of guys and nice coaches, helpful, but it just wasn't like a top level. It wasn't a platform to go on to, you know, if you compare to the other guys in the top 10, I don't think it was that kind of setup until we were 15. But yeah, great group of guys and I enjoyed it. But squash until I was 15, 16 was just one of the sports I did, I guess. I didn't have any idea of if it was professional, didn't have any idea if it was like the same as playing football professionally. Basically, if it was just like, yeah, every kid says they want to do it, but I didn't know it was attainable or, yeah, I just had no idea. So I played a lot, probably played a couple of times a week at most until I was 15, 16, and then started doing Nick Burt over at Cardiff Squash Club. And then, yeah, he helped me a lot for about 4 years, and I started taking it seriously around that time because I started to improve quickly because instead of playing a couple of times a week, I just started training every day, focused on squash, whereas at 15, I was still... Now I was lifting weights every day. I was running every day. I was just doing, you know, playing rugby in school, football in school. It was just, I just wanted to be, you know, fit and strong. I wasn't aiming to be a professional athlete in any way. I just, you know, just loved trying to get out and do the quickest 5K I could and try and bench it was just competitive and in a physical sense, really, there was no end goal. But I suppose Nicole would probably say it was the perfect training program for a kid coming into being a pro athlete. Just because you just got a well-rounded base and then you're in a good place and robust, I suppose, before starting as a pro.
I put squash TV on at the club like last week. I was there for Canary Wharf, and a couple of times they were doing camps with the kids last week, and you were on a couple of times, and they were all kind of Well, some of them were not interested at all for a start, which is just that's another story. Just, you know, your kids just
Yeah.
they're playing at squash every day, but they've got no idea about you know, who anyone like couldn't they couldn't name you a professional player. But there was some that were a little bit more interested, and they were asking it's weird questions that kids ask, but they were asking like how good you were as a junior, and I couldn't remember, but I tried to give them the stat of like where you came in your like last British Junior Open as a like. You know, Joel's now like top 10 in the world, but he wasn't that good as a junior. And they could like couldn't believe it because they're sort of told that you have to be training all the time from like a young age to have any chance. And I'm like, well, that's not the case. There's quite a few people who've maybe started a bit later. And I thought like the example of that British Junior Open for you was like such a good example to show like it's not, you know, you can everyone develops at different rates. And the same like you said, not everyone gets the chance to play specific sport early on anyway, and I don't think it's a great idea just to do one sport either. I think you should be trying like lots of different stuff, but what can you what was that finishing position of the British? It was like
Well,
it was way down there, wasn't it? It wasn't, you certainly weren't on the podium.
I never got into a British Junior Open, so that's a starting
All
point.
right.
Take it
In which case I've made that up.
down. I would have been good enough probably for British Junior Open in my last year, but I mean, under 17s, British nationals, I lost in qualifying for the top 32.
Yeah,
I
that's
didn't.
must be what I was thinking of. But that
Yeah.
actually makes it even better that you didn't even get into the British. I'll tell them that.
So then,
Yeah.
British Nationals under 19, I was in the main draw once. So I got under 19s. I played deck on the last first round. So yeah, and then ended up winning the plate, which was a big win for me at the time. So yeah, 17th finish was my best at British Nationals. But by the time I was towards the end of juniors, by the time I was like 18, turning 19, I was getting to a sort of a decent level. So I ended up finishing. I mean, for me, this was a good finish again compared to the other guys around my level now. It's irrelevant, but I ended up finishing like top 16 in World Juniors. So that would be like, but before I was going 19, that was in, you know, like that was a decent level for me at the time. I got some good wins, beat some senior
Yeah.
players in 16. So that was like really good by the end compared to where, you know, not being in nationals first rounds and stuff. But yeah, up until 17, 18, there's really absolutely nothing to prove I was going to be any sort of level.
It's really it's probably pretty inspiring for kids like that, because that's a massive improvement as well, isn't it? In like a year, 1 or 2 years, really, from
Yeah,
going like
I was
that to
training.
top 16 world.
Yeah, I just didn't miss a day from about 16 to 19. I improved quick, but I trained once or twice a day every day for like 2, 3 years at a young age. So I was strong by that age physically, even if it wasn't like squash specific. So I could take like a decent amount of workload, I think, which was helpful. I would like get the kids playing a lot of sports and like lifting weights and getting the S&C right and getting their bodies right from a young age, just because then the training as a pro, as we all know, is so hard, isn't it? When you first start trying to train twice a day, you're so sore, and like the squash movements are so bad for your body. You need to be robust and able to shift your body around and run and things just to make sure you can maintain the training load that's needed to play at the top level, I think.
Yeah. Talking of training, I suppose I know depends how many secrets you want to give away, but I know that you also do quite a bit of like a lot of work in the boxing gym as well. And I think that's probably quite an unusual. I don't know many other squash players who do that sort of training, but I know you've talked sort of the benefits of that for you, and also again being like completely sort of different. You can almost switch off from squash, but you're still getting like really good. So that conditioning, well, I think you actually said to me that it's like basically the hardest thing, you know, it's hardest thing you can
Yeah.
do, really.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't. I would say the boxing I'm doing it would be completely unrelated to squash. I'm not doing it to like improve my footwork or like a few people were like really good fitness session for squash. I was like, couldn't be less to do with squash, really. It was more just it's been something I've wanted to do for ages, and I follow all of it. Like, if I was gonna watch something, you know, when I get back to the hotel room after a match, I'd be having UFC on or listen to podcasts about MMA and watching. I watch those kind of things every day, probably. So that's always been something I've been into. And then when lockdown came, I just sort of thought it was a good opportunity to. There's nothing else on, so I might as well get into something else. So ordered a bag and a couple of love gum shield for the boys and
off you go.
But yeah, I was like, people always like worry about hurting your hands and damaging your wrists. And obviously it when I was younger, it seemed like such a ridiculous thing to be, you know, going and sparring before a tournament, which it probably is. But I just sort of thought it was what I wanted to do. And, you know, as long as I was decent technique and go into a proper gym and learn what I was doing properly, rather than obviously not just turn up and swing in a big right hand, but actually learn basics, because it was interesting. So, yeah, over the last 2-3 years, I've just, whenever there's a gap in between tournaments, try and get in 2-3 times a week.
I think that's coming through in your post-match interviews as well a little bit. You can see you're laying it out there to the other boys, and it's good to see.
I just got visions of you giving Miles an uppercut in the back garden.
You do.
catching him off guard.
Poor Miles.
Yeah, Miles was all right, actually. He held his own pretty well.
Toughened him up.
Miles and Jack in the garden doing a bit of training. It was, the lockdown was hilarious for that. I wish I've recorded a lot more training since then, really. So I didn't start posting any training content until after that. I wish I'd had some training from that lockdown, because there was some absolutely hilarious of Miles, Jack, and just training in the back garden. Like, bought a load of equipment the first week as lockdown happened. As everyone, just like, you just got huge ropes, punch bags, got like a 35-40 kilogram sandbag, weights vest, pull up bar, just doing proper training. We turned one of the rooms into like a little gym, so we had a spin bike from Priory, and then we had an Olympic bar with like 100 kilograms of weights on it, just in one of the rooms downstairs. So the training was even more intense than normal, I'd say, through lockdown, because there's nothing else to do.
And you did the David Goggins challenge, didn't you? What is that for people who don't know it?
One of the many ridiculous sessions we ended up doing through lockdown. So, the guy, we obviously always trained hard, and I'd started following all of David Goggins' stuff, listened to all of his podcasts, and I liked following a bit of the ultra running and things like that. And we'd always sort of said, so he posted a challenge that he did, which was to run 4 miles every 4 hours for 48 hours.
I remember this. Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah. And I was just basically said to the boys, or whichever way around it was like, I'd do that. Absolutely. No problem. Like, and the boys all confirmed that they would easily do it as well. So,
when locked down, confidence high, Wolvesgrove Drive.
Yeah. So we just all agreed that, yeah, if we needed to, one squash was done, we'd do that. And then obviously lockdown came in, and it was at the time at the start where it was getting extended by 3 weeks all the time. So we just said one night, if it's extended by 3 weeks again tomorrow in the announcement, the next day at midday, we start running for 4 miles at midday. Obviously, we were watching the TV, and another 3 week extension. So it was like, boys, get your kit on, we're going out. So it was a great experience, I would say. We all sort of went out, probably went out a little bit too quick, predictably. I think my average time was 31 minutes for every 4 miles. I know that's far from quick, but staying under 8 minute miles when it's like your 38th mile and it's now 4 a.m. sleep deprived for 2 days, like holding like 7.5 minute miles was a good effort, but really at the time, we all went out and it got pretty tough. It was more about the sleep deprivation than it was about anything else, because obviously if you leave at, say you're running at 8 p.m., then you get back at, say, 8:30, cool down, have a bit of food, and then you're obviously back out at midnight, so you can try and get a little bit of sleep back if you want, but midnight, you're back out 4 miles, and you're getting pretty sore at this point. So then midnight, you get back at, 12:30, a little bit of food again in the middle of the night, a little bit of a token cool down, get in the shower, get an hour of sleep, and then you're back out at 4 a.m., then 8 a.m., and it's just the...
Relentless.
Just how enough it is. It wasn't a physical... You're obviously physically tired, but you're never unable to complete the 4 miles because you've trained for years. So that wasn't the problem. It was more just getting up, getting back to bed, getting up, getting back to bed, a little bit of food. Then you feel like you've eaten too much because you're obviously running again in 3.5 hours. yeah, it's really...
Jack, Jack had a few innovative methods to deal with his blisters, didn't he?
Well, actually, that's another story. But his Jack ended up having, so about about 30 miles through, it was 4 a.m. and I limped down the stairs with various issues in my hips and knees. And I came downstairs into the living room, and Jack had one foot up, and he was just sellotaping a sponge to the bottom of his foot. Because I think Jack had run most of it in his squash shoes. And his the arch of his foot was obviously in quite a bit of pain.
You're not too worried about your blister last week then after that?
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. That's what it is. It's about Goggins' whole message in it, calloused the mind, and then you matches feel easy at that point, don't they? But
did you all finish it? That challenge. Yeah. Did you run different routes each time for the 4 miles, or did you have like a set, like a loop?
We had a few loops. We did. Yeah. One thing we found was that running on grass took a bit of the impact out. So we ended up doing a few loops of a nearby pitch and taking the impact out. But yeah, Jack, we probably should have known at that time, because it wasn't a blister that he was worried about. It was like the arch of his foot was just not flexing correctly. He was taping these sponges to the bottom of it and then tying you up around it. And not that funny really for him, but he went on to do some crazy things on his own. So he moved down to London and he ran from no training. He ran a marathon on a Saturday and then marathon on the Sunday, just from zero. So he ran 2 4-hour marathons back to back and then a half marathon every day for a week. So he was putting up impressive numbers. And he's torn something in the arch of his foot,
and he's never run since.
He has ran in 18 months, so he's in a place with his foot. But I guess that's the point where you're pushing through an injury there, which we all encouraged each other to do. And he's actually pretty injured from that.
Well, this comes back to your preparing well and getting your weights in and making sure you're a rounded athlete before you take on some of these challenges and take on sports career, maybe.
You got to be robust, because if you can do that, you can certainly deal with a match with a blister, can't you? So that's the way.
Going back onto the early PSA days. Then I remember in your sort of first season, maybe you played quite a few tournaments in England and similar thing. But I remember you having a result you weren't too happy with down in, I don't know, the Kent Open maybe, and you put yourself through some pretty tough sessions after that. How were those early days? Because you were balancing, obviously, coaching, and it certainly wasn't easy. Well, not that it's easy for anyone, but at the time there wasn't much support. You weren't getting much support, and it's pretty tough down at the bottom there.
Yeah, it definitely is. Because I was training hard with the intention to get up there, but obviously at the time I had nothing to prove that I was going to be at any kind of level. So you just, you know, one of hundreds of guys starting out at 20, you know, 19, 20 without any funding. You're trying to coach to pay bills, trying to squeeze in an extra league match which is hurting your body more than helping it for £100 at best. So, the early days I was just cramming as much work in as I could, and it was as much hard volume as possible, really. But Miles reminded me a couple of days ago of just one particular tournament of cramming where, as everyone did, you think that you're going to get fit from squeezing one more session in. So me and him did, I think that was when we were staying on the Vale actually at the time. So it was first year of uni, and we ended up, Miles met me at the house and we did, I can't remember what it was, say a 10K run. And then we finished with these hill sprints up this massive hill. And we just did 10 sets of this sprint to the top, walk down to the bottom, sprint to the top. And I'm going to really draw on this session, tomorrow when I fly to Gibraltar. I got on the flight the next day. My hamstrings were like in pieces, really, because I was training hard, but probably not. I wasn't doing hill sprints because that was just a random thing I'd added into the training like before. So, body was feeling terrible. And then I flew there, played two qualifier matches for a 5K, and I just about scraped through, but I wasn't feeling great actually. And then the second day, the DOMS hit and my quads and hamstrings were just in pieces basically. And I had to play Rob Downer first round, and went 2 love up, but in agony really. And then he broke me down 3-2, which was a brutal lesson at the time. Very solid in those 5K levels, and he'd stay on there for a long time if needed. And Gibraltar in the heat, it was it was just such a perfect example for up and coming pros, like just cramming sessions in pointlessly with no aim a day before going to an event. But we've all done it, haven't we? And certainly come off with 13 points and £100 at best and back on a flight.
And so now, obviously, these days you got you work with Mark Burns, but it seems like your training is a lot more structured and scientific, I suppose, with a bit of support.
Yeah, I've certainly done plenty of stupid training and got it wrong, but I've probably trained, professionally for 10, 12 years, I would say. So you make a load of mistakes doing that, don't you? Which tells you what your body responds well to, what sessions you need to get in before playing an event that are going to make your body feel good. And then if you've got a bit of a body, you can get in over a few weeks to then feel good to go again. So I just learned, as we've all done, by getting it wrong. And Mark Burns knows what he's doing. So we ended up going to the gym. He opened his gym up in lockdown, and we hadn't done any work together before. We just, as far as I was concerned, it was Jan's mate who came to the odd night out. We both
loved him.
And he'd be 10 pints of Guinness in, telling me what's wrong with my movement. And we'd just be, just having an argument about some sort of ridiculous lift that, I didn't even know him. And then wake up the next day and wouldn't speak to him again for a few months. And then Jan's mate would turn again. I'd have had 10 ciders. And we had a catch up about weights and then left it. So I didn't really know him at that point. And then 2 or 3 years ago, I saw him at the university when everything was closed. And we had access to his gym. So we started working together, and I obviously realized then at that point, he knew, what he was doing at a good level, actually. And he studied squash a lot over the last couple of years. And I wanted an SSC coach who actually knew about squash, because a lot of them just want you lifting without an aim. They don't really appreciate the demands of just how actually hard it is to move at a top level. So he was someone who understood it, and I could show him a few sessions I'd been doing and what I was trying to get out of it. Because I feel like I've built up quite a good knowledge of SSC and training from getting it wrong and doing it myself. So it's actually been really helpful, because I've talked to him loads and loads about stuff since. And I think he's now probably the biggest SSC coach in squash as a result of the stuff we've been doing. And he's working with about 20 different pros and half the American Canadian juniors by the sound of it. He's done really well since then. And built it up from just being the University of Birmingham SSC coach, essentially. But really knows what he's doing, and helped my training go in a bit more of a, gave me a bit more direction, and just tidied a few things up, I guess, which you need as you get older. But as you train for years, you do get smarter as you go on, don't you?
Older and wiser.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
So that's that, your S&C stuff. What about from the squash side of things? What's your kind of setup, like coaching setup at the moment? Like, are you working with anyone in particular, or are you taking ideas off a couple of different people at the moment, or still doing?
Yeah, I probably had last 4 or 5 years where I've had my own kind of direction with it. I've always done a load of work with Miles, because we trained together for years, and then he's moved into a bit more of a coaching role in his own career. And we always did stuff where he would feed me and we'd watch matches back, and he's quality for that. You probably know what I mean. Yeah, I think you mentioned that in a few of the podcasts, where I think he understands the game at a higher level than he can play it. Like, where he's at a level where he's actually got a good understanding of what's going on, good understanding the technique, and he's seen me train for years, so he understands where I'm at with what I'm doing as well. So he's great to have in my corner. Like, through Canary Wharf last week, it was, it was quality having him there. It's good.
Yeah, saw him on the front row and in between games.
Good laugh having the boys that we started playing. Just doing condition games and at university, and like playing a shocking level. And it's nice to have him done all the training over the years and all the absolutely boring repetition with, and still working well. So I've enjoyed that over the last couple of years. And then I thought I wanted to have a little bit of direction from someone else, really, at that point, because I'd taken it on myself. So I spoke to Johnny Williams, who I'd always kept in contact with. We got on well. I'd seen him, I probably knew him from about 10 years before, where I played a 5K at his club once and we ended up talking, and he was just such an analyst of the game, isn't he? And he knew every stat and every result from every match, and he sort of sat me down talking about my backhand and my movement, and then as I'm approaching the ball here and there. So he's got a very good, like, clear understanding of squash at a very high level, I would say. And he's really looked at it. He's not just, oh, do this, mate, like me, kind of thing. Like, it's not just a copy of the swing and you want to do that. And I just thought it was really thorough and analytical. And he sort of sat me down watching a few matches back, and he's writing notes and calling out any errors I'm making from any areas. And that ball's come loose from there. Why has that happened? And it was just really on the ball and no messing around. So it was probably what I've needed. I've enjoyed it. So I went to spend a week with him at the start of this year, and then I'm going for a week again before the British Open.
Yeah, awesome. One thing, like I've said, seeing your sort of rise firsthand is your kind of like resilience to, you know, when you have a step back. I mean, I remember when we were in Australia, talking about the British Junior Opens, but we played a 5K in Australia. I think you took home about $56 in prize money. And it went out first round of a 32 draw to Josh Masters, who's obviously, you know, was a good player as well. I got top 50, But I don't know, just that resilience. I think that for the next tournament, you then won the next tournament, which was your first title. But yeah, just that, I think that, and even after some big matches like the Commonwealth, like that resilience and being able to put it behind you, I guess, and just like, yeah, put it behind you and you know, on to the next, back to the drawing board, or, you know, say, analysing it. And that's something that Trezor, we can probably say that, you know, some of the lower ranked players maybe get a bit too emotional about it. I don't know, that, and that you find it, you know, when those sorts of things happen, it's, you know, you're almost like, oh, that's it, you know, I can't keep going at this rate.
Weak thing, really, on that.
Yeah, I guess that would probably be the biggest thing I would tell someone if they were starting a pro career, is that, like, there are going to be times where it is going to be miserable, and you're never too far away from, you know, flying to Australia thinking this is the tour that's going to, you know, start my career off, and I'm going to be 80 in the world, and I'm going to have four titles behind me, and I'm going to be, you know, ready to step onto bigger and better things. And slumped outside the club, 3-2 loss to Josh Masters in Shepparton, and the organizer comes and gives you $58 in an envelope,
and the marking sheets to do the next match.
And yeah, do you mind getting up, mate? We got they're ready to go. Actually, they've knocked up. So it's going to be miserable, isn't it? I think we both probably were opposite ends, maybe not opposite ends, but different stages of our career there, Jay, where we went off together for that tour. I was probably 19 thinking this is going to really kickstart my career, a couple of titles and I'll be out of the small tournaments around Europe. And you were probably thinking, like, a couple of tournaments through the summer, make some good money, win a few titles, and yeah, like,
wow.
Yeah, yourself probably.
I don't know if I was deluded to think I'd make a bit of money, but I mean I also lost to Josh Masters. I will add that in that tournament. And it was a chopping, actually, I think. But yeah, that was tough, actually. That was an interesting, because I remember leading up to that, I felt like I'd had about 6 weeks where I hadn't had any tournaments, because it was like June or July, wasn't it? So like season in England had finished. I remember, like, really genuinely, like, putting in, you know, a good stint, knowing that I was going to go and play these tournaments, and obviously the flight, things like that. It's pretty, you know, it's quite a big expense to be doing at that time of the year. So
feeling really good then, were you?
I was feeling bloody. I remember, I will throw this in, actually. I remember we went down, Jod's playing in front of, with Rob, and played in front of Jonah, didn't we? And I remember, I remember, like, feeling great. You know, I actually took you out there. I'll get that in when I can. But,
Pretty tight game. I think it was 9-9.
It was brutal, but I thought I was playing pretty well there, and then just, you know, went out to that tour, and again, I think I probably didn't deal with Luke, like, in the first tournament I played. I lost in the final to Kush Kumar, who I'd actually beaten not long, like a couple of months before that. But that really, like, that, from that losing that match, I was like, I don't know, I just sort of lost my head almost for the rest of the tour. Was like pretty brutal. Like, I didn't really enjoy it. Like, I didn't enjoy the conditions out there, the courts. I mean, it's all a bit soft, really, but you know, needed that resilience. But yeah, that was pretty tough, actually, I think. And like I say, different ends of the spectrum. That was a good example of, you know, a tour where she's not really enjoying it, and let it get on top a little bit. But yeah,
I think it would that was a big trip for me, like mentally in a different way, where it was like, wasn't massively enjoyable. In my mind, it had been Australia in the summer, you know.
The British summer.
Yeah, their winter. I didn't realise that.
Well, I knew it wasn't going to be quite the peak of their summer, but I didn't realise it was going to be snowing. So it was a bit of a shock, and not many places had, not many of the clubs had heating, did they, Jay? So it was absolutely brutal. The hits we had there, it was tough.
Money good was being shelled out left, right, and centre, wasn't it? For brunches and hotels. And
I mean, for me, I just stopped university at that time, so I'd taken a break from uni, so I'd finished my first year, and then I thought, this is it. I'm gonna, this is my breakthrough. Stopped university, did coaching flat out for a few months, saved up money for flights and hotels in Australia, and I was like, this is my big breakthrough. So yeah, when we had the Aussie Open first, and I played. So we'd gone out for 3-4 weeks training before that as well, hadn't we? So we'd done a serious amount of work, really. And I played Pilly first round of the Australian Open and lost like 4-5-4 or something like that in 45-50 minutes. And it was just, it was a bit of a shock. And then, right, okay, back 10 days before the next one. And then you end up, you're training, we're going in and out of billets places. And played Josh Masters, obviously, then lost in five. So it just ended up being this trip for the both of us. It was 8 weeks long and just couldn't get any wins, any money, really sort of came back from that and said there was some training I was never doing again, like threes, for example. Like, you've joked about that before. I was like, I'm never doing one on the door again after this. Like, this is just a waste of time. Like, I can't afford to be like going to Australia and losing a fortune. And like, this isn't working out, is it? So really gave me a bit of a kick of, if I'm going to do this, this needs to happen now.
One of the personal highlights of that drop too, actually, but cause we were sort of obviously trained together, but we were probably at that period as well where you were like starting to beat me, and I at the time I probably was like pissed off that I was losing someone who's like 15 or 10 years younger than me. But I remember like we were both out at that Aussie Open. You mentioned playing Pilly. I think I lost to Mahesh or something. But it was just like a Friday afternoon, wasn't it, in Melbourne? I just remember just being like, should we just go have some beers, mate? Like, fuck this, basically. Like, what else are we going to do? We haven't got a tournament now for a couple of weeks. So, let's just, I think we need a happy hour or something, mate.
And
we did. That was a good sort of bit of a groundbreaking few hours, I think, there. We just got stuck in, didn't we? A few beers and like fucking just let it all out, really.
Yeah. Been training so hard and it just seemed, it hadn't come together for either of us in any way, had it? We'd been there for weeks, maybe a month at that point. A couple of pints there was a good laugh, wasn't it?
Got schooners.
And
good mates after that trip, I'd say.
Yeah, and Clarkie was good. That was another highlight. Chris Clark, a regular listener to the pod. He was pretty hospitable to both. He put us both up, actually, didn't he, at his place in Melbourne?
Yeah, he'd only just moved over there, hadn't he, at the time?
Yeah.
Put us both up there for a week. He was at Canary Wharf last week. I saw him for a bit.
Yeah, he said, you've gone from, to someone who slept on his couch to his favourite player. So that's a favourite player to watch. So, quite a rise. Should we get on to the... I've got a few questions prepared for you, Joel.
Yeah, go for it, yeah.
A few more specific ones. We've sort of touched on some of these, I suppose, as usual. But first one, what advice would you give to yourself as a 19-year-old, knowing what you know now?
So it's so hard, though, isn't it? Because, without sounding like a massive cop out, it's like all these things we talked about is like you getting it so badly wrong that it gives you a bit of direction and it sorts you out. So I would probably say to like, probably getting the recovery and the training right from the start probably would have helped, because I think I'd certainly to start with left my best training, on a treadmill somewhere in Birmingham before getting to a tournament, and just from just no sleep, just thinking like I just got to push through and just having terrible performances purely because you've just stitched yourself up from a terrible flight and a terrible hotel and no physio and just cramming sessions in. But at the same time, that probably taught me a lot. So I don't really knock that massively. It would have probably been what I did, I guess, through through playing, you learn that, don't you? That everyone else has their own opinions on your career. Like you touched on a few times, Jay, like some bloke at Northwest County saying he doesn't think you're going to be a top 50 player. Doesn't really matter that much, does it? You just got to kind of plug away and you learn that on your own. You just got to have that single-minded approach to it, haven't you? Because everyone's going to say you've got no chance of being, you know, a top 10 player from the background you've come from. But if that's like, if you're actually fixated at like, that is what you want, and like nothing's going to take you off that path. You just got to have that kind of approach to it, I would say, which I did do. But there was times where, you know, it bothers you if someone's, you know, a player saying, you know, you're not going to do that, or some bloke saying you're not going to do that. I think as you learn over the years, you have to have such a single-minded approach if you want to do it. And it has to be completely because you want to do it, not because, you know, some bloke thinks this or someone's got their opinion the way you career. So
the age old how long are you playing for?
How much longer are you going to give it after you've lost?
exactly as you said, it's some guy like holding a pint, resting a pint on his belly on the balcony of, you know, Northwest League on a Tuesday night. He's never done anything in his life, but he's convinced that he knows you're not going to do anything as well. So thanks for that, mate. Yeah.
Just nonsense comments about whatever it is. He doesn't like the way you approach the ball on your backhand, or like, when are you going to start like working on your short game, as if that hasn't occurred to you yet in your career? Like, just absolute nonsense, really. And just being known from the start that how relevant that is, like, and just getting on with it, and just not, you know, being single-minded, I suppose, and just going, this is what I'm going to do. Maybe that pushed me to get up and train hard at times, like that kind of,
sort of proven wrong sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes that's a bit of a good push, isn't it? So again, I wouldn't necessarily want it any different, but you just, that was what I've learned, I would say, in one of the biggest lessons, I guess.
I think that does come back to what I said about, you know, your that resilience, and that, like, the fact that you know dust yourself off and whatever happens, and you know, you didn't get a medal in the Commonwealth but then you obviously played so well there, and you know, obviously next, you dust yourself off and go again, and just comes down to having that single-minded approach that doesn't really matter what happens, you're still gonna get up tomorrow and crack on.
I remember that Gold Coast, because that was almost, not really, but you had some good wins there, didn't you? And you were so close to medal. But I remember watching, was it maybe like the, I can't remember what was one of, maybe like the quarterfinals. I remember watching that in your flat, Jay, in London. We'd been out the night before, and we were like hungover, like on the Saturday morning, or whatever, and like 12 hours ahead, Joel's playing on a glass court, like Commonwealth Games. He's just had thinking, bloody hell. contrast that between how we're feeling right now is pretty sharp.
Joel knows the flat. He stayed there a couple of times. Anyway, we'll move on. Number two, your the favourite event that you've played? Easier question, maybe.
Probably the best audience and the best atmosphere for me, like the event I enjoyed the most would have to be Commonwealth Games in Birmingham. Not necessarily, like, it was a great venue and a great setup, but more just because, like, it was something I'd put in my head that was going to be a big deal in my career. And I was like, after losing that one in Gold Coast, it was like, in my mind, I was like, I'm going to win, and there's absolutely nothing, you know, I was thinking there's nothing going to get in the way of me like meddling this time and winning. So I was like, I had that in my head going into it over years. I was like, I've got to, that's like, that is a big deal for me over the next couple of years. And I always had that in the back of my mind. So that was great. Yeah, it's always good when family can all come across. We've got mates coming across. Like, it's actually a big deal, proper TV coverage. And there's actually a build up to an event. So I pulled out of stuff like 6 weeks going into it, and got together with Mark Burns and actually detailed a detailed training program for 6 weeks going into it, where like every session was studied and everything was perfect, and really like cut any nonsense out and just really got my head down. And that was, I was looking forward to that event then, because I was like, I'd done absolutely everything I could. There was nothing else I could have done in that event. So then it was just like, you got to go chips in here and just leave it all out there kind of thing. So it was really easy, great atmosphere. And like when everyone's there and they're going, you know, everyone's behind you, just a class event, playing at home, isn't it? In that kind of match, that would easily be a highlight for me, regardless of the result. I wanted to win that, but I just like left it all out there, and I couldn't, that's sort of the thing we're talking about, where like I couldn't ask any more myself going into that. So just as long as I emptied the tank, really, just like, you just got like can everything you can do. You're just going to chuck it all in there, dives, banging it in, like enjoying it, adrenaline. Like, if, what else can you do at that point? So, yeah, it was absolutely class atmosphere. And yeah, yeah, that would probably be it.
Probably good organisation as well, wasn't it? So, in fact, even let one of the organisers stay with you for about 6-8 weeks. not that there was any, there's no favouritism going on there.
Nice draw. You didn't draw, did you?
Yeah, the draw was good, wasn't it? That worked out well for you.
Oh, that reminds me, actually, Chuzzle, tell us about your bike story.
There's loads on.
So there's quite a few. Well, yeah, obviously, it was about 8 weeks before the Commonwealth, so I needed a place to stay temporarily. So I kindly was offered a room at Joel and Miles's for that time, leading up, not through the Commonwealth Games, but sort of lead up to it. So moved in, and I was cycling into the games offices each day, which was about 7 or 8 miles, maybe something like that. But it came at a time where I don't, for whatever reason, I got probably 3 or 4 punctures while during that time. And I mean, it's just ridiculous look, really. It's punctures. It seemed to be getting punctures. It felt like it was almost like every other day. And I was buying inner tubes, like you wouldn't believe, like having to side of the road, trying to change a tire. You know, like, it's just a nightmare. But the last day of the Commonwealth Games, so everything had finished. The medalists, everyone's left the building. The fans have gone, and you had about an hour or a couple of us just to basically start ripping the venue apart almost as soon as the doors are shut. A lot was happening, but you say, and basically for me, that's like end job done, really. Like, you don't need to, you leave and that's it. So I went to, I'd left my bike, I'd locked my bike up at the university, and went to go and get on it for the last ride home. And I was on a bit of a high, really, because obviously the event had gone quite well and feeling quite good about everything. And I walked up the steps past the university to get on my bike and realised that it wasn't there. I left it. I definitely left it there, because I'd left it there for a couple of days. I didn't cycle in every day, but so I'm pretty sure I left it like in that bike right there. There's some other bikes there, and as I got closer, I could see the lock was on the floor, but it had been cut. It had been like bolt cutted through, so they'd left the lock, but taken the bike. And I just thought, that's really, like, you know, taking the shine really takes the shine off things when I literally had my helmet on already. I'd walked up the steps with my helmet on ready, and I'd actually made a joke to one of the people I work with, because she said, "Oh, why have you got your helmet on?" I said, "Oh, my bike's up here. I'll see you around." And actually, as I was walking away, I said, "Unless it's been nicked, obviously." And literally within 5 minutes, I'd walked back down the steps, and I said to this girl, "It's been nicked. You won't believe it. It's been nicked." And anyway, yeah. So the bike was a goner. I mean, obviously, moving to Canada is not the end of the world, but I was going to sell it and try and get a few hundred quid for it. But obviously, that was taken out of my hands. So typical Birmingham, really. Like,
and that's life, isn't it?
All the good of the Commonwealth Games, and it's ruined because someone's like half inched the bike. I mean, I don't know. I can't. I just couldn't believe it, really.
Yeah, your love letter to Birmingham, the successful games, and that's what you get for it.
That's the thanks you get.
All right, good stuff. Number three, Joel, what would you be doing if you weren't a squash pro? Any ideas?
Like, to think I'd be doing another sport, I think. If I couldn't play professional sport, that is. I don't know. Yeah, I'd always like to be involved in sport, like real, like SNC, obviously, said like boxing, like MMA. So if I wasn't doing squash, I'd be doing something along those lines in sport, probably like CrossFit, something like that. I don't know about career-wise, though. I'd like to think I'd be able to transition into one of those if if it was... The opportunity was given to me, so I'll have to say that, really. I do just like following sport and enjoy it, and yeah, even if I couldn't do it, I'd like to think you could coach at a good level or coach the SNC and help pros. Yeah, something along those lines, probably.
Coaching, squash coaching, anything you'd be or interested in moving into?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, definitely it'd be something. I'd look at it as such an easy transition, isn't it? As we all know,
yeah.
From after finishing playing, you can do well doing it. Obviously, if you go to America or Canada, it's such an easy transition. I'd like to work with good pros, obviously, but I think everyone does after they finish playing. I'd like to think you could set up a base where pros could come in and out of and work with people at the top of the game. But that's, yeah, I think that's what everyone wants to do, don't they? When they finish playing, they'd like to work with the best players. So if I could do that, I would stay involved in the game. But I think I might want a bit of a change. I think after squash and being involved in it for a long time, I'd like to sort of potentially start again in something else and work my way up, maybe. Just have a complete change and a new start again. But yeah, there's certain things about coaching that appeal to me. I'd like to think, as we just talked about, the mistakes you've made over the years and training you've got wrong and then things you've had to work out, you could probably cut someone some corners and point them in the right direction in a few areas. So, yeah, I think I could do that. Yeah.
I can't believe you wouldn't want to be a grassroots coach hand feeding sponge balls to toddlers or blowing up balloons and getting, you know, the balancing on the racket. I can't believe you don't want to do that.
Some of that's my favourite work, mate.
Yeah.
If they want to be there.
The old balloon on a racket. Jesus.
Number four, nicely brought us on to the favourite sport to watch.
Yeah, it's got to be MMA.
Yeah.
I think, like, I follow all of the UFC stuff. So, yeah, it's just so much, like we were talking about with like boxing training or something. It's just so much more like the intensity of that sport and how like people think they're mentally tough in squash, like, and people like puff their chest out and sort of walk around like that. And it's comical really when you compare to these guys who, like, trained and fight for a living, and they're just like, the mentality to go and do that as a professional, I just think is unbelievable. It's like, so you have to be so tough and you have to back yourself, like the way they talk and the way they conduct themselves, they like absolutely back themselves in those kind of most ridiculously difficult situations on a big stage. And if, you know, they're risking getting knocked out in front of, or knocked out, choked out, like submitted by like someone in front of everyone in the world, the whole family, everyone they know. So I think that's like mentally such a brutal sport. It's like, I just can't, I find that just the best to watch in comparison to anything else. And it just, I think once you've done like even a little bit of training, like you can't believe how difficult that is to compare to squash. Like you start, you do a bit of sparring or you do a bit of something else, and like the adrenaline. Yeah, and I'm just talking about at an amateur level, you know, I'm not talking about at any kind of decent level. I just mean just going in and sparring with someone who's an equal size to you and level, maybe they're a bit better than you, just like going in there that and actually going and doing it. I think it teaches you a lot. And yeah, I suppose like mentally that puts you in a good place. So that's just, it's just not that difficult psychologically going and playing squash. Like in terms of people getting intimidated by situations or like that's so much more confrontational and so much more difficult. I think like, I don't know, I'm just impressed by the way they do that and the way they conduct themselves. And I like the way the coverage around the sport, they're allowed to be the characters that they are. Like squash, you tend to have to be constantly a role model, which is great. And they are role models, but I think like they're allowed to be themselves as well and just be like, yeah, I don't know, they're allowed to have character. They've got a lot more freedom, haven't they, I think. And they encourage that in their sport rather than like quieting it down. I think they're like, the more ridiculous they can be, the better. And obviously it spills over plenty of the time. But yeah, I just think they're allowed to be big characters and do what they want.
Any particular fighters to check out who are worth, got a good social media presence or whatever, or good videos of anyone in terms of interviews and training?
Absolutely loads in their sport. But I think one of the guys who won on the weekend that we went to watch was Leon Edwards, who's actually from he's from Erdington.
Right.
So
pretty tough then.
Local boy.
Yeah. So he actually moved across from Jamaica. His dad was involved in like involved with gangs, and his dad was killed when he was young, and then basically got dropped off an MMA gym by his mum, and he just kind of like started out fighting there just to get him out of getting involved in other things. And those are the kind of characters and backgrounds they've got in those sports. They've just got interesting stories. So he's built his way up and wanted to train out of Birmingham to show other Birmingham kids they can do it. And he's just built up his, he just defended the world title this weekend. I think he's only the second world champion to come from the UK and the first to actually train out of the UK. So that's quite a big deal in that sport.
Yeah, awesome. I'll look him up. Next question, the top places visited on the tour?
I had a good trip to. I do like New York. Obviously, I know you're there right now, but the Tournament of Champions is always class. But that is one everyone enjoys. I think San Fran was class when they're with. A few of us went out and went around the city a couple of times, and that was pretty class. Good glass court out on the bay there as well, isn't it?
Yeah,
really good setting.
Yeah, spectacular setting.
Yeah, any of those are great, aren't they? To be fair, we're looked after well whenever we go to the US. They're particularly good ones, aren't they?
Yeah.
And the bigger ones are just different, aren't they? Like some of the smaller tournaments, when you're coming on the way through, it seems like a million miles away from like playing on glass courts in Grand Central, doesn't it? When you're playing, so some of the like brutal, like it is tough, and so sometimes the level between being like the last man in the World Series there and actually like winning those 5Ks isn't as far away as you might think, but because yeah. There's some like good players struggling to win 5 and 10Ks around Europe because the levels are so deep. So it's been a bit like, I feel like a few of the guys like Charlie's just won 2 back-to-back 10Ks and he's just still like just on the cusp of getting into World Series. He can't play a World Series event, whereas you feel if he was actually put in a few World Series at the level he is now, like he could probably take a couple of people out, but he's stuck in that bracket where there's still, if he's not quite sharp, he can lose in the 10K semifinals because that's still a very decent level. And doesn't move anywhere, so you it's a bit of a bracket on the tour now where you have to be so good to actually like win 10K tournaments back to back to back to actually separate yourself and get into the world.
Yeah,
especially with no divisor, yeah, because the 10K is almost getting. Well, I was shocked to see this. I thought this was poor, but the fact that there's 3K events back sort of back on the calendar. I mean, I don't know if that's a whole rabbit hole we could go down, but yeah, that doesn't seem good that. You know, that size of event, and it's again attracting good quality players, and the fact that 10Ks seem stronger now than they were like 5 years ago. You're getting top 40 players playing them again because it doesn't really matter whether they win or well lose in the final or whatever.
I mean, there's the Irish Open's a 20K this year, and they've got Guad and like Waller's there, Abelgaard's there. Like, there's so many, like the level's just a joke in that tournament. I think Charlie's actually playing Abelgaard first round for $200 or something like that. I mean, that is a good level for $200. That is to go to Ireland.
I mean, that is ridiculous, isn't it? But it sort of devalues everyone else because everyone's the prize money up to 30 or 40 when you know you're getting an entry list like that off 20. And those 3Ks, like you say, it's almost there should be a ranking cap or something that you can't play a 3K if you ranked a certain level. If you're going to put them on, then I don't know.
Yeah, I guess the solution
like filters, it just sort of dilutes everything, doesn't it? It's
I think the divisor coming back would be the biggest thing. I think they talked about bringing that in from next year because that stops too many people playing, doesn't it? Like, there's no benefit to having those kind of people winning up and winning tournaments. It's just bad news for everyone really lower down, isn't it?
I mean, it used to be that there's only like someone like Jan Kukal used to have like he'd play like 24 tournaments a year, but he was like the one off, wasn't he? He was the only everyone else was playing like 12, 13, and because it didn't make any sense with the divisor. But I guess now without a divisor, there's more people that are playing like loads of events. So
yeah, there's loads of top players with 20 tournaments on easily at this point.
But I mean Charlie, I saw Charlie play in the final of the Guilfoyle, the second tournament he won in Toronto, and he was playing. I mean, I think he had to play Bellagio, who'd won a 10K the week before, like first round or second round. Then he played like Nathan in the semis, and then Curtis in the final. I mean, that's a strong route for 200 points he got. But I mean, it's hard. I mean, it's a good level.
Beating four people who've all won 10Ks already before, that's the problem. So losing to any of those is still a very good level, but especially if they play well on the day and it ends up not working out, but you move nowhere if you do that. You've got to be able to separate yourself from all those guys like four times in a year to actually even get into a World Series. And then you've got to, when you get into a World Series, take your chance. Like, you have to then turn to when you do, which isn't easy either.
Yeah, brutal. What ways do you think promoters could attract more spectators, or basically how can we get more tournaments like Canary Wharf on the any thoughts on that?
I think it has to be like entertainment first, isn't it? I think like there has to be somewhere you can get drinks. Like too many venues where there's just not even a bar, not any music, not any introductions aren't made priority. There's not commentary. It's just too many of them are quite amateurish, aren't they? I think like Canary Wharf just does it well. It's in good setup. It's got a class venue. You've got like a proper VIP area at the top where like there's bar. There's food served during it. There's just basics, like someone introducing players onto court, music. Like it has to be made a spectacle of. You can't like expect the sport to grow and attract new people to it if they're going to be sat in the crowd. They have to be silent the whole time during the match. They can't even have a pint. And like you're not going to have any casual fans at that point. You just isolate yourself to purists, don't you? They're the only people who are going to turn up and watch a squash event. Whereas we need like Nantes, where like a load of people had never seen squash before, but there's this glass court put up inside a castle. There's live music. There's drinks everywhere. There's food going around. People are like diving back to back, and then the crowd are going mental. There's 1,000 people from the first day there. I just think if the sport is put across like that, it looks class, doesn't it? We don't need to be playing in venues where like 15 people are watching the first round matches. I just don't think it does anything for the sport, really.
Yeah, good points. Bring it down a little bit. Yeah, drink of choice.
Yeah. Certainly started with cider for years. Most of the nights we'd have been on, because we haven't been out for a while, Jay, would be ciders. I'd say probably moved on to a few IPAs and a few. Try and keep the weight off now. Maybe forced into gin and tonics with that's some of the adaptations I've made from George Parker's advice, and Mark Burns, cut the calories out. You can't have 10 pints of 300 calories a pint over the weekend.
Smart. It's good.
My IPAs or lagers now, definitely, and I'm managing the odd Guinness now at this point. I've not been able to do that
until about Burns. Is that Burns' influence as well?
Well, yeah, exactly, yeah.
still struggling from quite a heavy St. Patty's Day, as they call it over here. Terrible name, St. Patty. I don't know where that's come from, but yeah, St. Patty's Friday there was definitely a few Guinness consumed.
Yeah, I don't know if you spoke, but he was, I think he was having a good time or a good weekend. He tends to have...
Every Friday is heavy for Burnsy, so never mind, the actual St. Patrick's Day.
When there's actually something on, yeah, it's different.
Good stuff. All these questions are sort of, rolling into each other quite nicely, but your tips for, so the British Open obviously is in Birmingham, coming up in April, right?
Yeah.
What tips for have you got for the spectators? Any spectators who don't know Birmingham, you're obviously a local boy there. Where would you recommend they go for eating and drinking and in that area?
If you're going to do that, you got to start with a few classics, haven't you? You've got to work your way through Moseley, I would say. You've got to go Prince of Wales for one, sit out the back, and then you've got to go across the road to One Trick Pony, then fighting Bull's Head. Miss out Bohemian and then finishing the Dark Horse. I'm sorry.
That's a good start. So that's sort of 12 till 3, and then you can roll into town, maybe hit the Victoria up if it's still, I haven't been there for a while. So maybe I'm out.
Sure, it's still there.
Yeah, I haven't been over there in a while. But yeah, you could go where have we been a few times with the guys. You can go into Temple Row, Head of Steam. Head over there for a couple around that area. You can't do there.
Lovely.
Plenty of places.
That just don't end up in snobs.
Exactly. That's the aim, yeah.
Oh, great. You don't get that. You don't get that on the In Squash podcast, do you?
slightly different questions, to be fair.
Your any sporting either heroes or people that you look up to that are current sports people?
Loop it all back around. It's got to be fighters, doesn't it?
What about growing up when you were as a teenager?
Probably looked up to the in terms of squash, it would have been like just the best British players. Like I grew up watching Pete Nicol and Nick just because they looked like the most kind of something I could base something around rather than watching Shabana and Rami. I enjoyed it, but it wasn't really didn't seem that realistic at the time. So the Pete Nichols and Nick Matthews, David Palmer, like those kind of guys where they were tough and physical and volleyed and just made things difficult for people. I always enjoyed watching. Yeah, and any of the fighters really are impressive. Like, any fighters like Leon Edwards, to be fair, like he's someone I followed for the last couple of years, and obviously like started from absolutely nothing and into establishing himself. Yeah, it's got to be Goggins, really, hasn't it? I think, like, what a story. Like, overall, I don't know if maybe you call that sport in terms of the ultra running, but Guinness World Records for pull up. 4,000 pull-ups in 17 hours. winning races over 250 miles, like pretty impressive stats. I'd say it'd be more something like that than yeah, favorite football.
Class, yeah. Do check him out. He's very entertaining for anyone who doesn't know. Definitely worth looking into. Number 10. Talking of challenges, and what's your best? Do you know your best five and 10K time?
I haven't done a flat out 5k for absolutely ages, but we've been doing a few treadmill ones because you set a decent time out, Jay. You set a decent 38, I seem to remember, which I couldn't believe when I saw that.
I think it was 39 something, yeah.
So anything
under 40 was the aim, yeah.
Yeah, so I do a decent amount of just like trying to do like a lactic threshold session where you're just trying to hold 4 minute Ks. So I do a lot of 40 minute 10Ks, but that's not like an absolute max out. I've done a few 37 and a half, but we've been doing those with on an incline, but on the treadmill, just so I could monitor my heart rate and stuff. So you put it on one incline just so it like replicates. Because if you're just on a flat treadmill, you can sort of turn your legs over a bit easily. So one incline tends to like be realistic to your times outside. Yeah. And then, yeah, 37 and a half is around the best I've done so far. I'd like to think fresh and going into it, I could take a bit of time off that. But yeah, I'm about 85 kg, so it's pretty tough at that kind of weight. If more like 75, I might be able to do a little bit better.
Miles is build.
Miles has done some quick ones. Yeah, he did. He's done some like, yeah, quick ones during lockdown. He was getting out and running. I can't remember what it was. I mean, he was running 36 and a half, 37. He was quick in lockdown. Me and him did actually go out to try and do a fast 5k in lockdown. Actually, I'd forgotten about that. We went, me and him went out, and obviously I was tracking it all on the Garmin watch, and it had been working perfectly up until this point. But I set it to go. We started pelting it, running like 3:20s, 3:15 minute k's, and I said to Miles through, I was like, mate, I'm flying here. I'm going to like push on, try and get a really good time on my own, because we normally ran together. So I've like pelted it off going like, this is unbelievable. I'm on for an unbelievable.
This is the one.
Hey, this is it. And basically I'm like sprinting, doing a good time. I did a 15:40, and I've like I'm sprinting, looking at the watch, it turns 5K, and I've like fallen on my back, like giving it large, going like 15:40 is absolutely unbelievable. And 20 seconds later, Miles like is absolutely past, and he sees me lying on the floor. He's like, what are you doing? And I was like, well, mine says 5K. And he was like, that was 4.6. So 400 meters short of about a 16:40. Yeah, which I was gutted about, but no proof of that because, the watch broke halfway through. So really quick, 4.6K. Need to go out and do a proper five now.
Last one actually is any one particular session or hard session that you'd recommend for people out there to try to challenge themselves with?
Yeah, I would probably go. I do like treadmill interval sessions. So one that's really tough because you can go a little bit quicker than you can do on the 10K is doing 1K 1 minute off 10 times. So you can do 10 sets of 1Ks, which is brutal, because you can go into like absolute red line because it's only for 3 minutes, and you can come back out for 1 minute and go back up. So that's one where I get the most red line out. And that's a pretty awful session, I've got to be honest. That is miserable. And 45 minutes of just this, the treadmill is just, there's nothing going on either, is there?
Nothing changing, is there? It's only getting harder, really, if anything.
It just gets, your heart rate just gets higher gradually, doesn't it? Because you recover a little bit, but then it goes to a slightly higher point than it was at the first. And it's just a miserable session. So I'd recommend that. And yeah, anything like that, just doing 1 minute on, 30 seconds off for an hour, something like that, just to test the mind a little bit. Just go.
Well, it might make you think twice about going for a half chance volley drop there when you're at full stretch or whatever.
If you need to some of the time. Yeah, 40 sets of 1 minute on, 30 seconds off is just, yeah, that asks you a few good questions that you might be asked at 9 all in the fifth. So that's the, yeah, they're some of the best.
Just need a good podcast in your ear and off you go. Awesome. Well, last one. What I know you like to, you're into your grime, UK grime scene. What any recommendations for music wise for these brutal sessions to get you through it?
If you're in there, you just want a solid daily duppy mix. That's what you want. Spotify mix. You just get it done.
What was it?
A daily duppy mix. Yeah, that's a good UK grime stuff. I probably spent too much time with Burnsy, mate. So it is just all I hear now when I go in the gym is just some like techno on absolutely non-stop from start to finish. 3 hours of lifting with a warm-up at the start, and it's blasting in the gym every time I go in.
Quality. Well, we should probably let you. I'm sure you've got. Well, you definitely got more important things to be doing with Optasia. It's coming up tomorrow, is it?
Why don't you go for that? Do that flat out 5K. Do it today. See how the legs are tomorrow.
That's what I mean, mate. This is maturing. This is the next phase of the career. This is.
And what's your draw like? Has there been a redraw for you with Asal no longer in it?
I've got Surav or Augusta Swords tomorrow night. So they're playing tonight. It's to play Marwan One now.
Rather than Diego, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So marginally better, you could say.
These are best of five this week.
Yeah, it's best of five all the way through, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Should be good, mate.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot for coming on. I'm sure, there's going to be. Well, you've actually got a bit of a social media following, so this could really take off here. We could be more than 150 lessons.
Reluctant social media presence.
I'm on it now, pushing it all the time.
Yeah.
Getting the training sessions out.
Yeah, so I saw that the content has increased a little bit more, getting into it.
Serious stuff now, mate. This is it. Yeah, cheers for having me on, boys. I enjoyed that. I like the season two like addition, having both of you there. Quick fire questions. I like the format. I needed a poignant ending, really, after Phil's. I needed something a bit more intelligent after Phil's ending last time. I was absolutely summed up playing professional squash in about 2 minutes there. I always wanted to do. I thought he was unbelievably articulate and got it right there, I would say.
You should probably cut that clip, actually, and put it on YouTube or something.
Yeah, you should use that again, because he just sums up, people who dedicate their lives to one thing. It says a little bit about your character, and everyone's got that kind of shared knowledge of each other is on the squash tour. And I was like, mate, I've always wanted to say that, but
Northwest drive home a little bit cheerier.
Had a good laugh on the way back there.
Class. All right, mate. Appreciate it. Good luck this week.
Yeah. Cheers, boys.
Cheers, mate.
Yeah, mate. Cheers.
All right, bye.
Absolutely awesome stuff there from Joel. I think that was a great insight into getting to know him a little bit better, but also hearing what life's like on tour. As Joel said, he has it's come from the bottom to the top, to be honest. So great to hear about it from his point of view, and to hear just how down to earth he is and the hard work that it takes to get to the top of the game. Hope you enjoyed it, and look out for the next one coming soon.